Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. His name is Brian from Bristol, and his home group is the Miracle Group.
All right, Brian.
This is awesome. There's a clock up here. I need my phone. Good evening, everybody. My name is Brian Kennedy, and I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. I use the term recovered not because I'm cured of this disease, but through a 12-step experience, spiritual experience, I have been lifted. The obsession of alcohol has been lifted from me. It's been a very crazy day, a long, long day, and for like 2 minutes, not even 30 seconds, I wanted to hit Jeff up and say, listen, man, the weather's really bad here in Bucks County. I can't make the trek out there. Can we reschedule? And God just would not allow that to happen. I have that thing going on called honesty today. I am from Bristol, Pennsylvania. My home group is the Miracle Group. My sobriety date is April 4th of 2010. I have the honor and privilege of working with sponsees. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor as a working knowledge of 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tonight, you know, I'm here to do my best to share my experience, strength, and hope with you guys. I take the ride up here, and I'm always thinking, like, when I come do the hour speaker, that with, you know, I have an anniversary coming up, you know, very shortly, and I'm always, like, in my head thinking, like, you know, I have friends that I go here all across not only the state but through the country these days, you know, do the hour speaker, and like, I'm in all of these people, and these are people that have 10, 15, 20, 30 years sobriety, and for some reason, I'm, like, driving here, and I'm like, you have to match the performance, you know, of that person or whatever, and, you know, like, a lot of the times, like, maybe they'll go into their experience, like, 20 minutes, and then they're just talking about big books and steps for 40 minutes and stuff like that, but, you know, I'm not here tonight to be a professor and teach you guys the steps, you know. I'm here to tell you guys what happened, you know, to me, you know, what my life was like, what happened to me, and what it's like today. And I forgot, I guess I'll be visiting you guys again next week, as one of my dear friends, Scott, is speaking with you guys as well, who's also part of my home group. My story, I grew up in a town called Westchester, Pennsylvania, in Chester County, where my friend Kathy, who came with me tonight, is also from. It's good to see Jimmy here, too. My life was, you know, I got lucky. I had two very loving parents. I have one sibling, a younger sister. I grew up in a development that had 15 houses that were built, you know, exactly the same. You know, you walked into each one of these houses. The kitchen was straight ahead, the living room was to the right, the family room was back to the left. And to the left, as soon as you walked in the door, in all of these houses was a playroom. Except when you walked into my house and you made a left, you came to a 6-inch thick wood door and a metal latch, and you walked in here, and we had a bar. You know, you had like the brown and orange and yellow, like 1970s wallpaper and carpet and whatnot, and the black and white TV in the corner, and the Beermeister, and we had a bar. So from a very young age, my family, my parents would entertain a lot. We had an in-ground pool out back. They would have barbecues. You know, the neighbors would come over, family members and whatnot. And I can just, you know, for the longest time, I remember being that kid, and I remember seeing all these people having the time of their lives, laughter and smiles and staying up late. And you know, I wanted that. I wanted that happiness and that joy and everything like that. And what I saw was these people with these laughter and smiles, that they all had cups in their hands. You know, like, I thought, I was like, all right, you know, one day I'll be old enough to have, like, that kind of happiness, and I'm going to have that cup in my hand. That's what I thought. You know, I remember being, like, 8, 9 years old, you know, my grandmother, you know, out by the pool, and she had that empty pitcher thing. I saw it was, like, a big cup with a handle and stuff like that. And, you know, she was like, Brian, you know, why don't you be a good boy and take this for Grandma and fill it up for me? You know, and I'd watch my father and the people pull that lever and fill it. You know, I wanted to be a good boy for Grandma, of course. So, you know, I took the pitcher, and I went up. I took the little stool, you know, to stand up to the Beermeister. And I, you know, I filled it up, and I took a couple steps with this thing, and it was probably, you know, half of my height or my weight. And it started to spill, you know, so I was able to put two and two together. and sip from the pitcher enough so that it wouldn't spill. And I can tell you I'm not one of those alcoholics that's going to sit here and tell you that I hated the taste of alcohol. I liked it right then at 8 or 9 years old. I knew that I had that faucet in the bathroom, in the kitchen, in the laundry room, and then I had this other thing you pulled and liquid came out, and it was cold and it was bubbly, and I liked it, you know. That was my first experience with the taste of alcohol. I was the only Catholic kid, you know, the only kid that went to Catholic school in my whole neighborhood. And everybody else was a couple years older than me, and they went to the public schools. And I can tell you that, you know, they were aware that I had this special room in my house. You know, so weekends would start to come about at like the age of 12 or whatnot, and my friends would hit me up. And these were all guys that I looked up to. And they would say, Bri, like, you know, all of our parents are going out tonight. Like, we're having girls over, and we're going to hang out in that room at your house, you know. And so, of course, you know, I was searching for acceptance of my peers, you know. So it was like, all right, cool, you know. And I couldn't talk to girls, so, like, they were bringing girls. I was fine with it, you know. And I had watched enough television that, you know, they would come over, and I'd be pulling cobweb-covered bottles of dear Lord knows what, you know, probably was grenadine and triple sec and something, whatever, and just pouring into these cups. And then these friends of mine would go home later that night to their parents and trip over and throw up on their parents', you know, shoes, whatever. And, like, I was the good kid in the neighborhood, honestly, you know, but I was deemed the bad kid because I was providing the alcohol. But there was no major consequences. I probably got, you know, grounded or whatnot, but they were my first early experiences with alcohol. I did what I thought pretty much most people did. You know, I went through high school. I had my friends on the weekends. You know, we would go get very, you know, classy, good beer, like Milwaukee's Beast and Natty Light, you know, at 30 packs. And we would go hide in the woods, and we would drink, you know, Milwaukee's Beast. And there might have been a little non-AA literature green substance with us as well. You know, but nothing major, you know. I'd come home, you know, if I got caught by my dad, I got grounded or something like that. But, you know, everybody else was doing it. I didn't have any major consequences. It wasn't an issue with me. I was very involved in my high school and grade school. I played sports. I was the goalkeeper for the soccer team. I was varsity all 4 years. I played rugby 4 years, played basketball. I was involved in student council. I was the president of my senior class. You know, so there was, like, to me, it was doing everything that I was supposed to be doing in this world. Colleges were looking at me for scholarships for soccer. You know, I, in fact, actually ended up getting a scholarship to Bloomsburg University and went up to Light Street, you know. My first taste of freedom, when I got up there, I ran with it. You know, I didn't have to report to anybody when I came in from parties any longer. Dad wasn't sitting there with his little Ben Franklin glasses, like, doing paperwork and then looking up above them to see the condition that I was in. So, you know, I just took off with it. And part of my story is that my father is more or less like my hero. You know, my father, to me, did everything right in this world. My father was born and raised in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. Where Yingling, of course, is brewed. I've met Dick a couple times. He wanted to be the son he never had. My father's father died when my dad was 21 years old. My grandfather, who obviously I never met, was a postal worker, and he smoked 2 packs of Lucky Stripes a day, and one day he dropped out of a heart attack. And at the time, my father was going to school at the University of Scranton. He actually went to work for Yingling. It was, you know, emptying the trucks and delivering and whatnot, like 50, 60 hours a week to take care of his mother and his younger brother. And then he eventually, you know, I guess because of the happening, his father went into the healthcare field. And my dad retired about 3 years ago. He was the CEO of a hospital for 38 years and a very involved member of our community. I never understood him. My dad was a workaholic. Like, he'd come home from work, put his briefcase down, you know, eat dinner and go back to work. And one of the biggest parts of my life was trying to make my father proud. You know, a B-minus was not good enough. You know, it should have been an A. You know, he coached me in club soccer for years. You know, if we won 4-1, it should have been 4-0. You know, it was tough. But I guess he just wanted the best for me. And, you know, I might have had resentments towards him for a bit, but that's over. You know, I go up to Bloomsburg. I take off with this take up with this freedom. And once again, I find myself, you know, searching for acceptance of the people around me. I wanted to be cool. You know, I thought that what made me cool was that I could drink more than anybody else in my freshman class. And I'm going to these sorority parties, these fraternity parties, whatever parties. You know, and I'm the last person of the freshman or sophomore classes that's out drinking with the upperclassmen. And I'm out drinking until 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, after all the other, you know, freshmen or whatever went home. And I thought that that's what was going to make me cool. But, you know, with drinking like that, you know, we had morning, afternoon, and night practices for soccer, and I stopped showing up for practice. I stopped showing up for class. I decided to, you know, I decided when the option was given to me to full, you know, pull a 4-foot bong and play Nintendo tennis or something like that instead of going to class, you know, and that's what I did. little run-ins with the law started to occur. After my second semester there, I had to see the head of discipline for the, you know, whatever, 6th or 7th time. And he more or less said, you know, I should probably call the police during this one. He's like, but he's like, I'm going to make a deal with you. You know, we won't call the police and we'll just say our goodbyes and you leave this university. And I was like, fair enough. So I did. And, you know, it was very, very difficult to make that phone call to my father and say, you have to come up here and pick me up. You know, I failed again. You know, but he came and he picked me up and he took me back to Delaware County, Chester County area where we lived. And I went back to the community college and things were going whatever. But shortly after that, part of my story is that, you know, we were out to dinner. We were going out to eat, my sister, my mother, and father and I. This is maybe 6 months after my return. And we're waiting for a table at like an Outback Steakhouse or something like that. And we're sitting at a bar. I'm 20 years old. I think at the time, 20, 21 years old. And my father stops and he points to the bartender and he says, you know, why don't you do this? And I'm like, what, bartend? He's like, yeah, you're really good with people. You're personable, you know, this and that. And, of course, it's like anything Dad wants me to make him proud. I was like, all right, I'll try to do that. So I became a bartender. Not good. Not a good occupation for this alcoholism that I didn't know that existed yet. But I did. I went to work at a sports pub in my area, one of these bars with, you know, 40 televisions with every sports game on, and you know, all the female bartenders had shorts that were about that big, and, you know, the type of clientele, it was Budweiser drinkers and Jack Daniel's shots. And what I found quickly, though, was that I couldn't stand any of you people on the other side of that bar. Like, I had no patience and tolerance for you guys whatsoever. You know, I just wanted to strangle 95% of you. but I also quickly learned that if I got on the same level as you guys, I could deal with you. You know, if I started drinking once I got to work and I got on the level, you know, then I was tolerable. You guys were tolerable. So I did. And living that lifestyle for quite some time, you know, going into work and start drinking at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, whatever you want to call it, morning for me after a while, until, you know, you shut the doors at 2 o'clock, lock up, and then, of course, you have to unwind, and you're unwinding until 5:30 in the morning, whatever, and then you're racing home to get home before, you know, the birds start chirping and the sun comes up, you know, and maybe some other non-affiliated AA substance came apart. I mean, after due time, I swore I had fangs. You know, what happened, though, is that after living that type of lifestyle for some time, you know, I started waking up in the morning, 3:30 in the afternoon, I mean, to my hands shaking, you know, and then it got worse, and the convulsions, and waking up, and just, what is this? And I didn't know what it was at first, but I learned quickly, though, that if I got to work, and I grabbed that bottle of Belvedere, Absolute, whatever, I mean, I could get tasty when I'm a bartender. You could drink the Grey Goose, whatever you wanted. Nobody was checking, you know, so you got to drink the good stuff there. But that's what I had to do. I'd get to work, and I'd start drinking immediately, so those shakes went away. I figured that out quickly. And that repetitive lifestyle went on for years of living like that. So in due time, though, living like that, you know, consequences did start to roll in. You know, the nights that I had off, I had also drink the same way that I did, and I'd start going out with my friends. I was going to bars. I had a pregame, you know, before I could even go out because, God, I couldn't afford a drink like that at a bar, you know. You know, DUI started to roll in, you know, disorderly conducts, fights and whatnot, you know, a whole list of shenanigans. And I still didn't see it as an issue. You know, I just thought that that's what normal people did. You know, my family members started to talk, you know, started to talk to me, started to come at me about me having a drinking problem, that I should start to think about rehab. It became a nuisance, you know, like they wouldn't leave me alone about this thing, like on my back, just like bugging the crap out of me about this, you know, and it was just like, I'm not doing anything wrong. You know, like mom saying, like, Brian, you are slowly killing me. Like, mom, I'm not trying to hurt you. I'm just hurting myself. It's fine, you know, kind of thing. You know, and after a while, the nagging got so great that it was like, all right, I'll go to your rehab, you know, and I'll go there. And I did, you know, and I went there and I yessed everybody to death. You know, like, sure, go to meetings, get out of here, get a sponsor, do these things. I'm like, whatever you're talking about is a cult I have no interest in whatsoever. And that's exactly what I did. I left. You know, I maybe went to a couple meetings, didn't listen to anything you guys had to say. I'd walk outside of these meetings, and there'd be, like, you know, 15 of you guys all standing around in a circle, smoking cigarettes, laughing, having a good time. I didn't know any of you. I gave you no chance. I didn't put my hand up. You know, I didn't feel part of, so immediately I gave up on it. I got in my car, left, and never came back. That's what I did. And my consequences got worse. You know, I went back to drinking. My consequences got worse and worse and worse. I guess it was about 2005. And I was at a bar. You know, I left this bar one night at whatever, 3:30 in the morning. My friends were the owners of it. And I got pulled over. This was my second DUI. I punched a police officer in the face. They knew me. We had a history. I think I flirted with the wrong cop's girlfriend or something like that. And so they took me to jail. They double cuffed me, you know, to two different bars. They pepper sprayed me. You know, it was an ugly scene. During my preliminary, you know, the head arresting officer came to me and he said, you know, Brian, he said, you were a 0.43 blood alcohol level and you almost passed a field sobriety test. You know, do you think you might have an issue? I'm like, whatever, just send me to jail. I remember, like, you know, I remember going back to a detox because I didn't want to detox in prison. You know, so I went back and I did that, you know, before my arraignment. And, you know, when I got to prison, I thought, this is that bottom that they're talking about. You know, here I am in Chester County Prison eating green ham and green turkey and sleeping on a 1-inch mattress on a cold metal slate and, you know, just living the good life, trading sugar packets for cigarettes and everything. And that's what it was. It was like, this is it. Like, look at where your life, look at where your drinking has brought you now. And thinking, like, this is it. I've learned my lesson. You know, and when I got out of prison, I was put on house arrest. And my parents wanted nothing to do with where I was going to stay and be on this house arrest. They said, you're not welcome here, you know, after this. So my employer at the time, I was a foreman for a landscaping company, and he was renting the house next to him. So he let me stay there, and I was able to work for him. And I think it was like a week went by out of prison, and my PO, who was supposed to stop by any time he wanted to give me a random breathalyzer or drug test, he just didn't come, you know. So, like, that night, a friend of mine was like, I'm going to stop by. And I'm like, yeah, grab a 12-pack. Come by. And within a month, I was back to drinking 2 half-gallons of vodka a day. I drank, you know, I was in the shower with a cup and a straw. I was shaving with a cup and a straw. Before I could drive to the state store, you know, I had to drink about a fifth of vodka to get the shakes down, you know, so I could drive correctly. It was always very difficult for me to watch that movie, that Nicolas Cage movie, Leaving Las Vegas, because that was me. You know, like, basically get into the freezer in the morning and having to chug vodka until I could breathe correctly. But I had something missing inside of me. I was an empty shell, and that's how I dealt with everything. That's how I dealt with every fear I had. That's how I dealt with every uncomfortability. That's how I dealt with not being good enough for my father. That's how I dealt with breaking up with whatever girlfriend was that. I mean, that was how I dealt with everything. You know, I just wasn't aware of it yet. In a short time after, you know, being on house arrest and starting to drink like that again, one morning, you know, my boss said to me, you know, you're suspended from work until further notice. Like, you know, you're showing up to work, you know, inebriated all the time. And I'm thinking, like, I'm not drinking in the morning. Like, I'm not coming to work drunk, you know. And he's just like, yeah, it's from the night before, you know. And then he started to talk to me about, like, DUIs on a tractor. I'm like, is that true? Really? Like, you can really get a DUI on a tractor? He's like, yeah, you know. So we had it out this morning, and you know, we're rolling around in this big garage, and like he has me by the throat, and he was just like, I'm watching you kill yourself, you know. And, you know, 2 weeks prior to that, I'm in this house, and whatever, we want to talk about bottoms and stuff like that, but like I, you know, I had started to see this absolute desperation, hopelessness, and just isolation, you know, like I didn't want to see anybody. I'm in this one room, you know, and maybe the bathroom back and forth. I had actually put a small refrigerator in the room, you know. And so when he said that to me, just something kind of happened that day, and I just broke out in tears, and because I knew he was right, you know. So I accepted his help, and they put me in a treatment center. And I was there for like 11 days in a detox. And the CEO of this rehab happened to be a family friend, and he pulled me in his office after being there for 11 days and was like, look, you were here last year. He's like, I know why you were here. You came in here to lessen your sentence before you were arraigned. He's like, you got out of prison and you were drinking in no time. He's like, I'm not going to let that happen again. So he's like, I'm going to send you to Florida. And I was like, whoa, like, hold on for a sec. That's a big thing to chew on. So I went back to the detox lane. It was like January 20th. I went outside to smoke a cigarette, was out there, like, shivering like crazy, throwing up all over the grass, of course, you know. And I'm like, wait a minute, like, I'll take a 30-day vacation to West Palm Beach, Florida, sure, you know. So I went back, and I agreed to it. And I went down to this rehab, and it's beautiful, you know. Crystal clear blue water, white sands. I knew when they were going to talk me to another 30 days of rehab. I mean, we got like 3 hours between, you know, lectures to like play volleyball and sit by the pool. I was like, I'll do this for another 30 days. This is great. And I kind of okayed that second 30 days because I knew they were going to try to talk me into a recovery house, and I wanted nothing to do with that. And so after 60 days, the guy, my counselor, who to this day, this counselor was one of those guys, like, I could not manipulate. I could manipulate every counselor you put in front of me, but this guy I could not beat. He nailed me on everything, and it was just like, how do you know this stuff? But, you know, he was from around here. You know, he had worked at a high school called the Glenn Mills School with bad kids and stuff like that. He actually played center field for the Houston Astros one time. He was just the guy's guy, and I liked him, you know, and I worked with him. And he was like, you know, what are you going to do after this? I said, I'm going to go home. I have to go home. Why do you have to go home, Brian? I said, well, my family's there. You know, I have a pretty good job there, and I said, and I have, you know, a couple girlfriends there, I think I said, you know. And he laughed at me, and he said, you know, your family can come visit you here anytime. You know, you can go visit your family. He said, there's plenty of work to be found down here. And he said, and honestly, Brian, where else are you going to find girls in bikinis 12 months a year? That's a good point. But then he started to talk to me about that I needed to relearn how to live my life without the use of drugs and alcohol, that I had no idea how to live my life without the use of drugs and alcohol, like nothing. I had no coping skills, all these things. I had no knowledge of. I had never given this program, Alcoholics Anonymous, a chance, and that I was worth it. And so I accepted it, and I spent, you know, the next 2.5, almost 3 years in the program Alcoholics Anonymous, and things started to get really good. You know, I took the suggestions of these counselors. You know, I got a sponsor. I started working the steps. I got myself a home group. I got commitments. You know, I started making coffee. But I can tell you today that my white surrender flag was still kind of half-cocked. You know, I still hadn't completely accepted all the things that I needed to accept. And it became more... You know, there's no reason for me to sit here and lie to you guys. It became more to me like a social event, you know. I got into a relationship after like 7 months of sobriety. You know, I was going to whatever meeting she was going so that no other guys would hit on her. You know, I was putting my hand up and I was trying to throw whatever Gucci crap out of my mouth I could to sound cool. You know, but like all these things started, like, you know, I wasn't drinking. I wasn't doing other non-affiliate AA substances, and I was showing up to work. I was getting paychecks. I was, you know, progressing on these stages of recovery. You know, like I moved on to a three-quarter house, and the girlfriend was now allowed to sleep over, which was awesome. And, you know, and then it's funny. Jimmy, I'll tell you, I have an American bulldog named Stella, who's like the love of my life. 85-pound pile of love. And I got this dog down there. In fact, one of my sponsees got like 100 days at the time and was like, Bri, I want to do something awesome. I want to buy something today. And I was like, we're not co-signing this kid buying a dog. And somehow this little puppy walked between my legs. And this was after he said to me, I'm going to buy this dog, and you're going to watch it for the next 3 months while I'm in this recovery house. And I'm like, yeah, sure. So I let the kid buy the dog. 5 days later, I pulled over on the side of that road on 95 on the way to a meeting, and I was like, kid, you're never going to see that dog again. I was like, I'll buy you another dog when you get out of the recovery house. So I'm in this three-quarter house. I get this dog. A week later, like, you know, you can't be here with that dog. So I move on to the next project. You know, I get my own house. I get a three-bedroom, two-bathroom, single-family home down there. I had a mango tree in my backyard. You know, I had the car, the girlfriend, the job, you know. And I'm like, you know, I'm paying a water bill. I'm paying an electric bill. I'm paying a cable bill. Like, all these things that this guy, this irresponsible menace to society, was never going to do. Like, only things that I saw people on television doing. Like, all these things that, like, my father was just, like, really proud about. Like, oh, my God, my son's becoming responsible. And it was like, you know, like, it was like, you know, long story short, I got cocky. I had arrived. You know, I got this thing. You know, I worked your 12 steps. I made your meetings. I got a couple sponsees. And I had my own house. The girl, all these. I had done it. And, you know, a couple months later, the girlfriend that I was living with sort of called me at work one day, and she was like, babe, you know, I want to drink. My boss's father was a heavy Russian alcoholic, so he knew what was up. He'd be like, go home, take care of her, you know, whatever you got to do, because, of course, I was all powerful, and, you know, I could save her. So I thought, so I'd leave work and go home, and I'd be like, come on, let's go to a meeting. And she'd be like, no, I don't want to. So I'd be like, all right, well, I'm going to sit right here and watch you and make sure you don't do anything stupid, you know. So, of course, I stopped going to meetings. And, you know, like a month and a half of doing that, you know, I was spiritually bankrupt. I was completely disconnected, mentally drained. You know, I walked in from work 2 hours early, and she was sitting there on the couch with a drink in her hand, and I sat down right next to her. And, you know, the consequences rolled in real fast, you know. It came to the point basically that I couldn't be in Florida anywhere. It's like you realize that, you know, you take yourself wherever you go, you know. And so I moved back up here. I was a dry drunk for a little bit. I decided that I could go back to the bars locally and drink soda and eat wings and watch Phillies games for like a week. And it got right back to it. You know, got right back to 2 half-gallons of vodka a day, waking up convulsing and just insanity. I heard a speaker on Friday night at a clubhouse in Northeast Philadelphia called Stepping Stones, and he wasn't talking about it, but it put in my head where today, you know, like the other night, you know, I worked my rear end off, whatever, I was tired, and I came home, I got a hot shower, I put like the most comfortable sweatpants on, a comfortable t-shirt, you know, sat down on the couch, was able to pet my dog, NCAA basketball was on, you know, Temple was playing that night, I ordered General Tso's chicken, and like, it was like, boom, like, I got everything I need right now, you know, some friends are coming over, like, I didn't need anything else, and like, this psychic change that has occurred, because before, it was like, let me finish work, you know, I have 2 half-gallons of Absolut at the house. I have a gallon and a half of Pawpaws just in case, like, a, you know, meteor shower comes or something like that, you know, just in case. You know, I have, like, 37, you know, Budweisers, whatever, like, this many of these things and this many of these things. And it was like, I'm good. Like, I don't have to go anywhere. I don't have to leave. I'm good, you know. And, like, that's all my life was. Like, that was, I was so obsessive about just that. And that was it. Like, nobody else mattered. I was the most self-centered person, you know. That's all my life surrounded me. I mean, I had other relationships in my life, but nothing challenged the relationship with my alcohol. And that was everything to me. And, you know, the last drink I had was on April 3rd of 2010. And I woke up shaking and convulsing, and I drank my first half gallon of vodka, and I knew that within a couple hours the shakes would come back. And this woman, that was a friend of mine, had said, "Brian, like, have you ate anything in like 2 weeks?" You know, and I said, "Probably not." I mean, that was getting in the way of my alcohol. I was absorbing the alcohol. I didn't want to deal with that. You know, so she said, "You got to eat something." You know, I had every dollar that I had at this point. You know, I was on a Suboxone regimen from some other stuff that you can entertain. You know, I was selling my Suboxone to be able to afford my vodka. You know, it was just every last dollar was going to alcohol. So she comes to my house with like $200 worth of food. And I had said to her when she told me about this food, I said, "Listen, the state store is like three spots down from Gennardi's. Do me a favor, stop there and give me another bottle of vodka." And she said, "I won't do that for you." So she shows up at the house and she doesn't have the vodka. And there was like no gratitude whatsoever for the $207 receipt of food that she had for me. It was just like, "F you, I'll go do it myself. Like, you're not my friend." So I got in my car. I drove to the state store. I picked up another bottle, and I got back in my car, and that's where I guess I got pretty foggy. I hit another car while driving with people in it. I don't remember. I jumped the median on Westchester Pike in my 2007 Altima. I cracked the axle. I didn't realize that, but I was wondering why the car was fishtailed as much as it was. I came to a shouldering stop, you know, at an intersection, and I slammed my head on the steering wheel. The car was smoking and everything. I came to, I don't know, maybe like 60 seconds later, people were yelling at me to get out of the car. And I realized it would have been a third DUI, you know, in a year in prison. And I didn't like the green ham or the green turkey. So I saw Woods, and I pulled the keys out of the ignition, and I walked sideways out of the car so I didn't turn my head so nobody would see me. And I booked into the woods. And I ran through these woods for 2.5 hours into the dusk. You know, I was running into trees and through prickle bushes, and I was diving into ditches and rubbing dirt on my face because I saw police. It was like Rambo stuff, you know. I didn't want to go back to prison, you know. So I somehow made it through those woods. And I'm talking like Westchester East Public High School was like between the woods and my dad's house. And it was like a football field and a baseball field and like a field hockey field, and like those whatever, like 97 seconds of me sprinting faster than I ever have in my entire life, because there was nothing to block me from those three fields, you know. But I made it back to my father's house, and he was retired and where he is right now with his feet in the sand down in Longboat Key, Florida, relaxing. And I thought about what I had just done. My only answer, of course, was to break into his liquor cabinet, which he had put a lock on 10 years before, and forget about what had just happened. And next morning, Mom calls. It's Easter Sunday. You know, "Brian, what have you done this time?" The police called. "They're looking for you again. Turn off all the lights in the house. Hide. They're probably on the way." You know. And this is her waking me up at 5:30 at night. You know, I had missed all of Easter. And she said, what are you going to do?" And I said, "You know, Mom, I don't know how many times I've gone to treatment, you know, whatever." I was like, I've just been trying so hard to be able to drink like all my other friends, and I'm failing, you know, miserably every time I try. You know, I need help." So the neighbors came, hid me in their basement in case the police were on their way. And they came and they took me to treatment. And I got to this treatment center this time, and first few days were very difficult. You know, I had a lot of guilt, a lot of shame, a lot of embarrassment going on. I was walking around with my chin on my chest. I couldn't look at anybody in the eyes. It was like, why haven't you people given up on me? You know, I'm the scum of the earth. I'm better off dead. And in, you know, reality, I had lost the will to live. You know, I mean, it was just one of those, like, if I die, it's okay. So I don't forget. I guess about 90 seconds after I fled from that car, it exploded. They said the muffler was dragging and some of the hoses came undone underneath the hood. So basically they said if I would have hit my head a little bit harder, I wouldn't be here with you fine people tonight. So, you know, I'm at the stream, so I'm walking around with all this guilt and shame. And the clinical director of this place stops me one day and she was like, "What is this? Look." she was just like, what's going on? And I spoke to her, and she was like, you know, what can you do about yesterday? What can you do about 4 days ago? You know, like, have you had enough? You know, like, have you tried enough ways to drink and do drugs successfully, you know, kind of thing? And, you know, are you willing to make changes necessary? Are you finally willing to take some suggestions that we give you? And, you know, I took what she said. I think that was also the same day, like, I couldn't call my mother. I was so filled with shame and guilt. And she laid one on me that day. She was just like, let me ask you a question. She was like, if Stella went to doggy rehab, wouldn't you want her to call you? And I'm like, F yeah, you know? And I was just like, all right, I see what you did right there. It's pretty good. I called my mom. But after she talked to me about that, I'm in my detox room that night, and I'm in this, you know, bathtub, and as some of you can probably relate, you know, I'm freezing and I'm sweating and I'm freezing and I'm sweating, and I'm turning the tub on hot water, cold water, and it's like 4 o'clock in the morning. Everybody else in this entire facility is sound asleep, and you know, spiritual experience, God coming in my life some way or another, whatever you want to call it, you know, like that's when my white flag came up. You know, it was just like, I can't do this any longer. Like, I've tried and tried and tried, and God, whatever you need me to do, just help me. You know, whatever it is that I need to be doing here, just show me the way and I'll do it. And, you know, I woke up to a whole new willingness and open-mindedness, and I started to listen to these counselors and their suggestions and not, you know, pass the notes to girls. Like, I was in to what they were talking about. And they started making these suggestions about, once again, going to a recovery house. And even though I wanted to say no, you know, I said yes. Granted, my parents, there was no invitation to go home at this point anyway. so I went up to a town called Levittown, Pennsylvania, which is 5 minutes from where I live now, and I'd never heard of Levittown nor Bucks County. I arrived at this recovery house, and, you know, I brought my entitlement issues right with me. And, you know, like I walk in and there's like a pleather couch and a pleather love seat. And there wasn't even a lamp in the family room. Like, it was just like, yo, this ain't going to work, you know. Like, I'm from Westchester, you know. You know, I was like writing notes, like for my mom. Like, you know, there's 6 forks and 4 knives and 12 dudes in this house. This is not going to cut it. Like, everything I could possibly do to try to sell my mother wasn't going to work. She didn't want to hear it. But the good thing was is that, you know, AA showed up, and guys came back to that house that night, and they started talking to me about their experiences. They started talking to me about the meetings that they were attending in the area. They started talking to me about their sponsors and working the steps, you know, and just, you know, wanting to help me. Like, the one guy was like, you know, did you get all your stuff from Westchester? I said, no. He says, I'm off tomorrow. I'll give you a ride and get it, you know. And it was like, all right, you know. And so for some reason, I stuck around, and thank God I did. You know, all these suggestions that these counselors gave to me, I started to go after. You know, I got into action. I got a sponsor, and not somebody that was my friend. You know, I went to meetings, and I listened to somebody that was all about this, that was enthusiastic about AA, and that was like twice my size, and that would not sugarcoat anything to me. And we got to work. You know, we sat down. We did 1, 2, and 3 right away. When I got to writing my 4-step, I wanted to procrastinate the crap out of it. You know, he'd call me some nights, be like, how's that writing coming, you know, and I'd be like, oh, you know what, I'm going to go to a meeting tonight. He'd be like, no, you're not, you're going to write your 4-step. You know, he actually would, like, pull in my driveway sometimes. I'm like, oh, my God, like, you're here? Like, you know, but he loved me. You know, sitting down and doing my 5th step with him, I was so petrified, you know. In the back of my head, I was like, I'm going to tell him all these things, but, like, these 5 or 6 things in the end, I am going to take up their suggestion of going to a priest and telling him these things, you know. And, you know, I sit down with this guy, and I'm thinking I am the absolute scum, like, of the earth, and I'm telling him these things. He's like, yeah, I did that. Yeah, I did that, too, you know. I was like, really? You know, and, you know, after like 3 hours of doing that with them, you know, like that weight that was lifted from me, you know, we went out and we sat together, and then he let me go off on my own a bit, and it's, you know, there's no words for it. You know, getting on to my character defects and taking a look at that, and, you know, the amends process, you know, that was, you know, I did a thorough 4-step, so when I got to my amends, it was pretty easy to write on that. You know, making amends to my family was, of course, the toughest. Going to my mother and father and asking them what I could do to make it right, and them saying, just keep on doing what you're doing, And there wasn't enough for me, you know. So I went back to my sponsor, and today, I mean, I'll mention I work in the field of drug and alcohol abuse today. And, you know, today I help facilitate a family group in New Jersey with a Catholic priest friend of mine that's worked in this field for 20 years. And I go out, I'm missing that to be with you guys tonight, but I go out and I do that from 7 to 9, and we do a two-hour group of basically the alcoholic and the drug addict, and then their mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters, and it gets very interesting, but it's an educational group for them. But that's what my sponsor suggested, if I wanted to make more amends to my family in another way, to do something like that, so I do. I'm the president of the Alumni Association of the treatment center that I went through. I'm very involved in that. Every Wednesday night, that's where you'll find me and my alumni group. I'm actually speaking there Wednesday night. But to me, you know, I remember that hopelessness and desperation I had sitting in a detox row in that treatment center and having no idea what was next for me or what we had to do here, and that, you know, I love going back and seeing those guys. You know, I love talking to them after the meeting and telling them that things can get better if they take some suggestions. After a while at this recovery house, the owner approached me. I was landscaping at the time, and he said, listen, I got a job for you, and I want to offer you a job. And he said, I want you to answer the phones for this recovery house. And I was like, I already got a job. I like getting my hands dirty. And he said, yeah, I think it's got a little more purpose. And, you know, so I talked to my sponsor. I talked to a couple friends of mine from that rehab, and they suggested it was a good idea. And so I did so. I became the intake coordinator of this place. And, you know, I saw a lot of things that were wrong with this place and things of that nature. And, you know, at the time, there was four houses. So I started doing some work with this place. And I guess after about 9 months, the owner had gotten married and had a baby. And he came to me, and he's like, Brian, you know, you never have to call me with stupid questions. He's like, you know what needs to be done, and you get it done. He's like, you know, I want you to become, you know, the director of this entire place. And I'm like, okay. Like, hold up. Like, let me, that's a big chunk. And, again, I asked the right people, and I ended up taking it on. And I also did, like, the sales and marketing for it. And when I say sales and marketing, I'm talking about going to the rehabs and sitting with these guys just like somebody did with me and talking to them about my experience, hope, and strength, and, like, you know, what my life had turned out to by coming up to a recovery house. And I expanded that program from four houses to 12 in like a year and a half. After a while, I started to butt heads with the owner of this place because the almighty dollar got to him. That's all I'll say about that. So I left them. I went back to, currently I work at a state-funded halfway house in Delaware County, where there's no money involved, and I get to just talk with guys and do my thing. But also recently, I have a lot of friends that work in the field, and a lot of these counselors know how much I like working with new guys. And a lot of these counselor friends of mine in the last year, since I left that place, strongly suggested that, you know, that I open my own houses. And about a month ago, I became a homeowner. You know, I rent a house that I have, a six-bedroom house that I have five other guys that live with me that are all, you know, a year plus sober and all good friends of mine, and I just became a homeowner. I just LLC'd a company. I just .com'd it, and, you know, it's going crazy, but I'm going to open up my own recovery houses, and I'm very excited about it. I just see a certain treatment that should be given to guys. You know, I remember the fears and anxieties of arriving at that house. And, I also remember, like, you know, the parents dropping the kids off and whatnot. So there's a lot of things I want to do, you know, with this business and whatnot. But, again, it's just like some days I wake up and it's just like, you know, is this really my life? You know, like, this was a dream of mine a year ago. I left this facility, and within 2 weeks I had 14 people ask me out for lunches. And we're like, Brian, you need to open up your own houses. I'll be your business partner, you know, and I'll financially back you with all this money. And it was like, all right, let me get this straight. Like, you want to do this. You know, I'm going to do all the work. My contacts, my heart's in this, whatever. And you just want to sit back and whatever. So I was hesitant about it. And then I flew down to Florida to visit my dad. And he just vacations down there. And I'm sitting on a beach one afternoon. Sun's going down and everything. And he was like, what are you going to do next with your life, you know? And this is like 15 minutes after I got off the phone with the kid that I got in a treatment center in Florida. And he said, you're still down here on vacation and you're taking calls for guys, getting them into rehabs and your sponsees and stuff like this. He's like, you never stopped, do you? And I said, you know what, Dad? I said, in my eyes, I should probably be dead. you know, the way that I drank and the way that I did other things. I said in my eyes, in my mind, you know, through all my experiences, that I have a responsibility to God and AA now, you know, to give back. And he said, I can see that. And he started talking to me about these people that were going to approach me as business partners. And I said, yeah, it's going on right now. And he said, that's why I'm going to be your business partner. And, you know, I took like a triple take. I'm like, you're retired. Like, you know, you're living the life down here. And he said, I know how much this work means to you, you know. And it was crazy because Kathy can tell you, and Jimmy can probably tell you, I'm a phone guy. I'm always on the phone, emails, everything, you know, Facebook, of course, all whatever. And, like, my phone was, like, you know, 1% on the battery right at that moment, you know. And I said, Dad, and my dad was like, I'm going to go up, you know, to the house. I'm like, God. I was like, can you plug this phone in when you go up there? And so, like, I handed him that. And then it was just, you know, me on that beach with no communication in the outside world, just watching that sunset go down. And it was just like, you know, it was such a God moment to be like, okay, you know, like I see the course in front of me, you know, like the path has been set for me. So, you know, I work hard at it right now. You know, I did take a time out last night to go down and watch the Duke game in Philadelphia, the college basketball games. That Florida Gulf Coast game was awesome. You know, AA to me, I can't speak enough about it. I, you know, the life that it's given me, you know, the hope that it gives me, you know, I live, eat it, and breathe it. And I'm not ashamed to say that. I remember being, you know, the other times that I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when I wasn't ready for this. And I remember, like, putting my hand up and, like, mumbling my name because I was embarrassed about it. And I thought, like, you might know my dad's buddy or whatever, and you were going to say, like, oh, my God. And, like, we saw, you know, Brian Kennedy at a meeting the other night, and, like, it was going to tarnish my name. That's who I am. You know, I'm proud of it today. You know, my dad still is a little iffy, you know, like, whatever, but now he's in. You know, my mother's very proud to say my son's a recovering alcoholic and he works in the field, you know, and stuff like that. I was laughing on the way here before, thinking about, like, how, like, most people just don't get us, you know, for the most part. And, you know, my father being CEO of a hospital and working in the medical field for as many years as he did, and I can remember, like, you know, 2003 when he was taking that ride to drive me to rehab and detox, and him being like, listen, you know, you got to go in here. You got to figure out whatever so you can come out here and have, like, two or three beers with your father one day. And it's like, yeah, absolutely. Like, yup, you're right. You know, I'm going to do that. You know, and it was just like, reservation check. You know, and then, like, 2 years later, you know, like, me coming in again, like, I need to go back to, you know, whatever. And him being like, are you sure you have a problem? And going around his basement and, like, just pouring out empty bottles of vodka. And like, yep, here you go. And just throwing them backwards at him. And, like, driving that same ride back to detox. And your father being like, now listen. You can never drink again. It was like, dang, what did he win? You know? You know, I was listening to a speaker the other night, and it does. It taught, like, you know, step 10, obviously, is probably the biggest part of my life, and 11, of course. And I was listening to a CD the other day. It's like, you know, like, steps 1 through 11 are like a springboard. You know, we work those first 11 steps to spring us into the spiritual life that we have. And, you know, God is a big part of my life. In early recovery, when I first got to you guys, like, I wasn't sure so much on the God thing because I felt that God had turned his back on me, you know, but I quickly learned that was me turning my back on God. You know, I can't say enough. If you're new, you know, don't be afraid. You know, AA can only do good for you. This is the place where you can turn your life around. You know, you got to do some work. You got to be brutally honest, I found. You know, I'm always open to tell anybody where I'm at, you know, because nobody judges me. You know, I joke, I go to Planet Fitness, and you see that sign that says, like, judgment-free zone. Like, that's us, you know. You know, I love working with my sponsees. I had, I was down at this meeting on Friday. I'll end with this. I was at this meeting. It was a 10 o'clock meeting in Northeast Philadelphia, and I met Ted M. And Kim P. down there, and my friend Ryan. And he's sitting there. It's now like 10:45, and he gets a text message, and he serves me his phone, and he was just like, you know, he's like, oh. He's like, one of my sponsors, he's having a rough time. He's like, I'm going to take him to, you know, a midnight meeting. And I'm like, good man, you know, whatever. I was like, which meeting are you going to take him to? He's like, 12 Keys. And I'm like, cool. And so we get done this, you know, 10 o'clock meeting. It's now like 11:15. I leave. I'm driving. I'm like 10 minutes from my house, and my phone rings. It's like 11:35, and it's one of my sponsees. And he's like, bro, you know, I'm going through it. You know, he's like, I'm staying at a friend's house, you know, that you know. And he's like, I can't stay here tonight. I don't know where I'm going to stay. And I'm like, where are you right now? He's like, I'm at the 12 Keys. I'm like, okay. And I'm just literally about to pass the 12 Keys. So I pull into the parking lot of the 12 Keys. I'm on the phone. I see him leaning against, you know, the railing. Like, he's still talking. I'm, like, putting the phone down, hanging up, like, put the window down, like, hi. You know, he's going through it. He's asking me about how I dealt with depression and willingness and all these things. And I was so tired, you know, like I couldn't stop yelling. I was so tired. It had been a long day. It was Friday, you know. And Ryan Roth comes, you know, Ryan comes driving in the parking lot, you know, with his sponsee in the car. And you know, he's like, what's up? I'm like, fancy seeing you again, you know. And I get out of my truck to talk to this kid, you know. And Ryan walks out of his clubhouse at 12:06 and was like, Brian, he's like, what are you doing right now? I'm like, nothing. He's just like, well, the chairperson and the speaker didn't show up, you know. And my sponsee looks at me, he's like, BK, I've never heard you speak. And I'm like, this would be like saying no to God himself, you know. So it was just like, yes, Ryan, like, let's do it, whatever. And that, to me, is how AA works, you know. We suit up and we show up, you know. We're in service, whatever it might be, you know, chairing, making coffee, setting up chairs, you know, aiding to the newcomer. I never say no. You know, again, like, I have a responsibility to God and to you guys because you guys were always there for me. This program works. It's done wonders for me, you know. The gratitude that I have towards you guys and all this just runs overfilled. So, you know, I'm very grateful that I was able to come out here to Quakertown with you guys tonight. And I thank you, and I wish you guys all well. My name is Brian. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic.
This group would like to thank Brian again for sharing his experience with us tonight. And this group would also like to remind anyone in need of a sponsor to please see someone after the meeting. Would anyone who has a working knowledge of the 12 steps please raise their hands? And real quick, if you guys will wait for us, Jeff has something to say.
God help us all.
That's why we're here. My name is Jeff Malcolm. It is absolutely my privilege to be part of this home group and sponsor people from this group and sponsor people in general, but especially from this group. And somebody had come to me, I don't know how long ago it was, two and a half years, who's counting, 2.5 years, and asked me if I would simply show them what it was shown to me. And I was absolutely honored to say I'd be honored to do that, yeah. And so we started on this journey. And Shelley was absolutely had an open mind and open heart and was willing to do some stuff, some of which I don't think she wanted to do at first, but she was willing. So what does that tell you? It doesn't matter what we want or what we think or what we understand, it's what we're willing to do. And she was willing to take some actions, and she has grown extremely in leaps and bounds since then, and I've seen it and I've experienced it with her, and it's really helped me grow and helped me get closer to this thing that I call God, this connection that I have with you guys in this world. And I thank her for that, because she's really, really helped me a lot to be even more connected than I was before, and I've learned a lot about myself through her. And I think that's how this thing works, you know. It's a give and take thing, you know. The more we give out, the more we receive. And I'm absolutely honored to give her 12-year coin tonight.
Hi, everybody. I'm Shelley Malcolm. I celebrated 12 years about a week or two ago, and today was the first chance we had to do it, and he had to drive back. He almost got here and forgot it. And Tree was kind enough to pick it up somewhere during the week. I had come around for 9 years, and, you know, it was a good social event for a long time, and I hadn't really had the freedom that I had heard when I started coming to this group. 4 years ago. I came here for a year and a half and just thought, yeah, I'm good. 9 years is good. It sounds great what y'all are saying from the podium. Brian had a great message tonight. And it took me a year and a half to really be like, yeah, man, y'all are talking about this great freedom and shit. And it, I got humble and a couple things happened and God directed me. I had no choice. God directed me to ask Jeff to sponsor me and walk me through the steps. And I can tell you that the last 2.5 years outweighs the 9 years that I spent here, like by leaps and bounds. Many of you have heard my story. I spoke last August here, and the freedom from the bondage of self, which it says in the third step prayer, is like was always so attractive to me. And you know, that was one of the things that Jeff always says to me when I call with 10-step work. And he's like, well, so you think you're better than them? And I'll be like, no. Okay. And he'll, we'll talk about it a little bit. And I'll be like, no, I don't think so. And he's like, okay. And he always says, just depends on how free you want to be. And that's the truth. You know, the freedom is relieved me from the bondage of judgment and everything so that to show up for work for God is a completely different life than I led for 9 years coming around here. You know, to absolutely, absolutely wake up every morning and know that, you know, God's my employer and all I got to do is whatever I can do to do His work well. If I stay close to Him and do His work well, He takes care of me. I don't have to worry about sleep. I don't have to worry about none of that crap because I get what I need when I need it if I'm working for God. And, you know, the whole business of working for God and just the joy of taking others through the steps is unbelievable. It's not to be missed. It's just freaking amazing. And I can't believe for years, 9 years, I had one sponsee in 9 years. Because who the hell wanted what I had? And I had nothing. And today I get sponsees, males, female, and I walk them through the steps. And a lot of them come and go. Some of them stay. And it's an absolute joy. And it's that two-way street. You know, helping somebody else at 12-step all the time, just out there helping all the time and watching them help others. And, you know, the joy in living a life directed by God and not running my show anymore. That was the big deal. Even 9 years I ran the show, and now I don't anymore. And, man, it's a lot easier. It's so much easier to not have to get up every day and fix, organize, manipulate, control my life. I'd just be like, I got nothing, God. Where do you want me to go? What do you want me to do? I'm just here to serve. That helping others thing is just like, it's just amazing. And in my story, I went from anger, resentment, and hatred from my stepmom to complete joy and love. In fact, I was just saying to one of my sponsors the other day, I miss her. I mean, I freaking miss her. I haven't talked to her in like 2 months, and I'm like feeling like, and I would have never, ever thought that. I thought I'd hate her forever. And, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because when I did my 4-step with Jeff and we sat there at the diner doing it, and I said, man, I love my dad unconditionally. It would be so awesome to love, like, everybody like that. That would be cool. And, like, that was just like a little seed planted. And then later when I did my amends with my aunt and uncle, it all came to fruition. I was just like, I can love everybody unconditionally. What a freaking awesome joy. And that's the deal. It's the love deal and not anything else. And it's all only because I opened up, asked, and waited for God to do the work. And you don't have to do anything except walk the steps and follow direction and argue with your sponsor sometimes who says, yeah, okay, depends on how free you want to be. And be like, no, I want to be free. So I love the last 2.5 years since I've been coming here and walked through the steps and helped others. And 12 years is nothing, really. I should just be celebrating when I started the steps 2.5 years ago, because my life has changed. The psychic change happened then, not when I put down the drink. So I love this group. I love AA. Thanks for coming up and speaking. Thanks a lot, guys.